Hello, this is Jean at the Talking Information Center, reading news stories from Reuters for Thursday, August 13, 2026. After U.S. criticism, Israel ties Lebanon withdrawal to Hezbollah disarmament, by Mayan Lubel and Maya Gabaili. Jerusalem, Beirut. Israel won't withdraw from southern Lebanon until Hezbollah is disarmed, the defense minister said on Thursday, qualifying remarks he made a day earlier that had suggested Israeli forces would occupy the territory indefinitely and drew U.S. criticism. Israel seized a swath of South Lebanon during a war with Hezbollah earlier this year and has said it will keep forces there to shield northern Israel from attack by the Iran-backed group, which ignited the latest hostilities when it opened fire at Israel 2 days into the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. Israel's offensive uprooted hundreds of thousands of Lebanese, most of them members of Hezbollah's Shiite Muslim constituency. During a visit to southern Lebanon on Wednesday, Defense Minister Israel Katz said he and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had been unequivocally clear that we are not withdrawing from this security zone, adding, we will cleanse this area and ensure the security of the northern residents. Following his statement, a U.S. State Department official said a permanent Israeli military presence in South Lebanon was not consistent with commitments set out in Israel's U.S.-backed deal with Lebanon's government. The deal foresees a progressive Israeli withdrawal linked to the verified disarmament of the group. The United States expects all parties to act in a manner consistent with the framework they agreed to, and Israel clearly stated that it has no territorial ambitions in Lebanon, the U.S. official said in written remarks distributed to journalists. Hezbollah, founded by Iran's Revolutionary Guards in 1982, strongly opposes Beirut's talks with Israel and has ruled out any discussion of its weapons before an Israeli withdrawal. On Thursday, Katz said Israel would not withdraw from the security zone in Lebanon as long as Hezbollah is not disarmed and the threat of Hezbollah in all of Lebanon is not removed. I have instructed the IDF to prepare for an extended presence in the area to protect the combat forces and the communities until this goal is fully achieved, Katz added, in a ceremony marking an Israeli settlement establishment in the occupied West Bank. Netanyahu's Likud party, to which Katz belongs, is looking to bolster its security credentials among voters ahead of an election on October 27, Israel's first since the Hamas-led October 7, 2023 attacks. Katz's statement echoed recent remarks by Netanyahu on Gaza and Hamas. On Sunday, Netanyahu said that U.S. President Donald Trump's latest Gaza roadmap was unacceptable, and that Israel would not withdraw before Hamas is disarmed. The U.S. brokered deal between Lebanon and Israel leaves Israeli troops inside Lebanon until Hezbollah is disarmed and the Lebanese military takes control of the south, a process involving pilot zones. The U.S. State Department official said the Lebanese military was implementing the first pilot zones, and Washington will continue to support full implementation of that process. Beirut resident Hussam Maneh said Israel cannot remain occupiers. There have been previous experiences. They occupied Lebanon and then withdrew in one way or another, whether through political negotiation or through war, he said. Iran's state media mock Trump over airplane switch. Meme shows him hiding in a catering truck. By Emily Giles, Alawi Ilweli, and Mallory Ghazi. Dubai. Iran's state media has mocked U.S. President Donald Trump after new details emerged about his secret aircraft switch during a visit to Turkey, saying it showed just how nervous he is about the Islamic Republic's power. Again, Trump, with his new scandal, has become the top subject in the U.S. media these days, a scandal stemming from fear of Iran's military power a power that caused Trump last month while returning from Turkey to secretly switch his plane, said a presenter on state television, adding that the episode has become a source of humiliation for Trump. A threat that Air Force One could be targeted by a shoulder-fired missile prompted the Secret Service to secretly move Trump onto a smaller government jet, a person briefed on the matter said. The threat emerged on the final day of Trump's visit to Ankara for the NATO summit, the source said, as tensions run high due to the ongoing U.S. war on Iran. The Secret Service deemed the threat to be credible and imminent, prompting an extraordinary operation to conceal the U.S. president's movements. The New York Times reported that U.S. officials were alarmed to discover that Iranians knew where Trump was staying in Ankara, including the exact floor of his hotel. Tehran has not officially commented on the allegations or on the airplane switch. The White House could not be immediately reached out of working hours. Billboards and murals around Tehran take aim at the U.S. president and Israel, showing images from Trump lying in a coffin to drowning in the sea. While the new Supreme Leader Mojtaba Khamenei last month pledged vengeance for the death of his father and predecessor, who was killed on the first day of the war. Trump and a small group of aides used a catering truck to switch from the big blue and white presidential aircraft to a smaller, nondescript C-32A jet for the flight out of Turkey on July 8, while Air Force One departed separately carrying senior administration officials, White House staff, and the media, according to the first source. Iran's embassy in South America said a post on X that Trump will be hidden in a trash can before long. It was accompanied by a meme picture of Trump inside a catering box full of food. The X account often goes viral for the social media memes it shares, which Iranian state media have reported. It is listed on the official website page of the embassy. The Washington Post first reported details of the plane switch operation. In 2024, the U.S. Justice Department charged an Iranian man in connection with an alleged plot ordered by Iran's Revolutionary Guards to assassinate Trump, then U.S. president-elect. Tehran denied those accusations in September 2024. Iranian hardliners who have been talking about taking revenge for the assassination of Iran's supreme leader on February 28, as well as some other senior political and military officials in Iran, are basking in the fact that the United States was so afraid and concerned about President Trump's safety and security, said Ali Vaez, Deputy Program Director for the Middle East and North Africa at the International Crisis Group. Iran and the United States remain at loggerheads over efforts to agree a permanent end to the war in the Gulf, according to a senior Iranian source who said there had been no progress in talks to revive the interim deal. During a podcast on Iran's semi-official Tasnim news agency, commentator Alireza Majidi recounted a 2018 visit by Trump to the Ain al-Assad base in Iraq, a country where Iran enjoys support from armed groups. Trump himself described the extraordinary security measures he had to go through on that trip. "If you had seen what we had to go through with the darkened plane, with all windows closed, with no lights on whatsoever anywhere, pitch black. I have never seen anything like it," CNN quoted Trump as speaking to reporters at the base in Iraq. Ukraine's farmers despair as Russia's Black Sea blockade traps their harvest. By Olena Harmash. Zhytomyr region, Ukraine. Ukrainian farmer Serhiy Rybalko lost two-thirds of his land when Russia occupied a large part of southern Ukraine at the start of the invasion in 2022. Now he is suffering a different kind of torment as a potentially good harvest is thrown into jeopardy by a Russian campaign of attacks that has almost halted agricultural exports from Ukraine's Black Sea ports. Ukraine is among the world's largest producers of wheat, corn and sunflower seeds, and around 90% of its exports of such crops go through the Black Sea. Compounding the problem, Ukraine's wheat harvesting campaign is at its peak. Rybalko's grain storage is already nearly full, and Ukraine's corn harvest is due to start next month. There is nowhere to send this grain, the 57-year-old farmer said as he stood at his silo. This is a complete disaster for farmers. Previously, Rybalko sold to major Ukrainian grain exporter Nibulon and to local processing plants, but now no one is buying, he said. Nibulon did not respond to a request for comment. Everything has just stopped. Finances have ground to a halt. Revenue streams have dried up. There are no exports, Rybalko said. Farming accounts for nearly 60% of Ukraine's export revenues, and the blockade adds pressure to the fragile wartime economy. Ukraine has increased its attacks on Russian vessels in the Black Sea and the Sea of Azov, as each side in the more than 4-year war tries to cripple the other's economy. As Russia is also a major food exporter, the escalation has major implications for inflation, as record heat waves and war in the Middle East, as well as in Ukraine, drive up costs. Ukraine supplies around 6% of the world's wheat and around 11% of its corn, said Denis Marchuk, deputy head of Ukraine's main farmers union, UAC. He warned of famine in some import-dependent countries across Africa and the Middle East, which are major buyers of Ukrainian grain, unless supplies arrived on time. Ukraine expects a grain harvest of about 60 million tons this year, almost the same as in 2025. But this time round, farmers have little hope for next year's crops. Without exports, they cannot raise enough money for the next harvesting cycle. While global benchmark Chicago grain prices hit their highest in more than a year in July, in response to Black Sea disruption and anxiety about shortages globally, domestic Ukrainian prices have slumped as local supplies have accumulated. According to analysts' assessments of all cereal crops, farmers will only be able to make a profit out of exporting wheat, and they will be unable to cover production costs for other grains. These funds are needed to continue purchasing fuel, pay wages, and prepare for the sowing of winter crops, said Marchuk. Rybalko, who borrowed heavily to rebuild his business after the start of the war, says his farm needs to make about 20 million hryvnias, $447.74 a month during the harvest campaign to service loans, pay wages, and buy fuel. Without those funds, the autumn fieldwork campaign was under threat, he said. The Black Sea, whose waters are shared by Bulgaria, Georgia, Romania, and Turkey, as well as Russia and Ukraine, is used to ship crude oil and refined products in addition to grain. Before the blockade, Ukraine shipped around 4 to 5 million metric tons a month of agricultural exports via the waterway, according to data from Ukraine's agriculture ministry. The country's shipments were also disrupted at the start of the war when the fears of a food crisis prompted the United Nations and Turkey to broker a deal allowing Ukrainian grain through the Black Sea. Although Russia exited that agreement in 2023, Ukraine launched its own grain corridor along the western coast of the Black Sea through the waters of NATO members Romania and Bulgaria. Shipments have nearly stopped again, as in July and early August, Russia launched more than 70 attacks on Ukraine's Black Sea port infrastructure and 62 strikes on vessels, the Ukrainian Port Administration said. Data on Wednesday showed grain exports plunged by 75% year-on-year in the first 2 weeks of August. Russia says its attacks target legitimate military infrastructure, logistics, and vessels transporting foreign weapons. Grain can keep for several years if properly stored and dried, but Ukraine's shortage of storage capacity could reach 11 million tons, the agriculture minister has said. Officials have asked Ukraine's partners to help provide specialized bags for temporary on-farm storage. They also say alternative export routes are urgently needed, and that finding them could prove much harder than before. In early 2022, when Black Sea ports were blocked, agricultural exports were rerouted on railways and roads through Ukraine's western borders. Oleh Nivivsky from the Kyiv School of Economics said the scope for negotiating alternative routes had narrowed, in part because of a deterioration in relations with neighboring Poland, whose farmers have previously objected to competition from cheaper Ukrainian grain. A stricter trade regime with the European Union, lower water levels in the Danube River, and Russian strikes on railway infrastructure have also limited Ukraine's options. Ukraine should prepare for the possibility that the economic consequences of the port blockades may be no less severe or even worse than last time, Nivivsky said on Telegram. The central bank said last month that Ukraine would lose about $2.5 billion in hard currency revenues in the remaining part of the year due to the blockade. Its farmers face about $3 billion in losses due to more expensive logistics, the UAC estimated, while Marchuk said it was too early to estimate the threat of bankruptcies. Already, the agricultural sector's wartime losses have exceeded $90 billion since 2022, and arable land under cultivation has shrunk by nearly a quarter due to active combat, heavy mining and shelling, and lack of irrigation. The government has introduced an emergency aid package for farmers, expanding state loan programs, easing lending requirements, and reducing interest rates for working capital loans. But on the agricultural front line, farmers need more help. The harvest compared to last year's and the wheat too is almost twice as good, Felix Fyodorov, a farm director in the Kharkiv region, told Reuters, but prices are half of what they were last year. As Rybalko struggled to pay wages and taxes, he was forced to sell some of his early wheat at a low price just to raise cash and pay for a few days of diesel. The most pressing problem is to somehow secure the next year's harvest. If Ukraine does not sow its crops today, if Ukraine does not sow rapeseed, which is needed by the Poles and the Germans, does not sow its wheat, does not sow its winter crops, and does not prepare the soil for spring work, then in a year's time, we will see a real food crisis. Congo reports Ebola death in new province, official says. By Reuters. Dakar. Democratic Republic of Congo health authorities have identified a person who has died from Ebola in a province not previously affected by the ongoing outbreak, an official told Reuters, raising fears of wider transmission from multiple exposures before and after the patient's death. The case involves a motorcycle taxi driver who traveled to Bas-Yul province, where no cases had previously been reported, from Haut-Uele province, where cases had already been confirmed, Jean-Jacques Muyembe, head of Congo's National Institute for Biomedical Research, told Reuters. The patient died in Bas-Yul's capital, Buta, after developing hemorrhagic symptoms consistent with Ebola and tested positive for the virus after he died, Muyembe said. Haut-Uele, one of five provinces affected by the outbreak, which was announced on May 15, has recorded 113 confirmed cases, according to the latest available government data published on Tuesday. Bas-Yul would not be added to the list of affected provinces until there is a case involving local transmission. But Muyembe said the motorcycle taxi driver visited several health facilities before his death, and fellow motorcycle taxi drivers tried to retrieve his body, prompting the local police to intervene, raising fears that several people may have been infected. The ongoing Ebola outbreak, Congo's 17th, has so far infected 4,566 people, including 2,128 deaths, according to government data released on Wednesday. The number of cases makes it the second largest outbreak on record, behind the outbreak in West Africa that landed from 2014 to 2016. Italy's Meloni has a youth problem as election approaches. By Anna Uras and Gavin Jones. Rome. Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni's government is increasingly unpopular among young voters, opinion polls show, a trend that could prove costly ahead of a national election due next year. Since taking office in 2022, Meloni has done little on the economic front to increase opportunities for the young, analysts say, while passing a raft of law and order measures that often disproportionately affect them. The result is a disaffection among 18 to 34-year-olds that may be crucial at a 2027 election, shaping up as a neck-and-neck race between her rightist coalition and the center-left opposition. Younger voters are clearly leaning towards the center-left. Lorenzo Preliasco, head of the U-Trend polling agency, told Reuters. Meloni's coalition, comprising her Brothers of Italy party, FDI, Matteo Salvini's League and Foreign Minister, Antonio Tajani's more moderate Forza Italia, now commands less than 30% of voting support among under-35s, Preliasco said. That compares with almost 50% in the same age group for the opposition bloc dominated by the Democratic Party, PD, the Five Star Movement, and the Left Green Alliance, AVS. At the peak of Meloni's popularity in 2023, U-Trend polling showed her party alone attracted roughly the same support among young people as the whole ruling coalition does now. Young Italians also present the same gender gap seen in other European countries, with men tending to vote for more for the right and women favoring the left, according to a study last year by Milan's Bocconi University, based on data from polling firm SWG. The sharpest party divides showed support for Meloni's FDI at 15% among 18 to 29-year-old men, and just 4.2% among women, while Five Star was backed by 18% of women under 30 and just 5.1% of men. Lorenzo De Sio, political science professor at Rome's Luiss University, said the main reason for young people's hostility towards the government was its inertia on economic policy. Meloni has made no significant economic reforms, he said. That is fine if you benefit from the status quo, but very bad for those least protected by it, which often means young people. Meloni's office declined to answer questions from Reuters for this article. Italy's employment rate among 15 to 24-year-olds is the lowest in the 21-nation Eurozone, Eurostat data shows, and it invests less in education than almost all its partners in the bloc. A young graduate in Germany earns on average 80% more than an Italian peer, according to the Bank of Italy, and tens of thousands of young Italians leave the country every year in search of better prospects abroad. The government's approval rating among under 35 voters is just 25%, compared with 35% among the overall population, U-Trend data shows. Meloni also faces competition for what remains of the youth vote in her own ideological camp. National Future, a far-right opposition party formed in February by former Army General Roberto Vannacci, is already polling at about 7%. Surveys show its strongest support comes from middle-aged men, but Vannacci also has a significant following among anti-immigrant urban youths who like his pledge to return thousands of migrants to their countries of origin. Vannacci is certainly holding up better with young voters than the ruling parties are, Preliasco said. The government's security measures have affected a range of groups, from prisoners to migrants, but young people have often found themselves in the eye of the storm. After cracking down on rave parties in Meloni's first law decree 4 years ago, subsequent government steps have targeted production of so-called light cannabis, disruptive street protests, squatters, and juvenile crime. A nationwide student protest dubbed No Meloni Day in November last year saw thousands march against the security decrees, education spending cuts, and Meloni's support for Israel in Gaza. In one of its latest moves, the government last month presented a bill to change the rules on the criminal responsibility of minors. Those aged between 14 and 17 who commit crimes will be considered fully responsible unless proven otherwise, reversing current rules by which a judge must show they understood the implications of their actions. A 2023 decree toughening sanctions for offending minors has already triggered a 50% rise in the juvenile prison population, according to prisoners' rights group Antigone. Yet while teenagers are to be fully responsible for their crimes, they cannot receive sex education in school without their parents' written consent, under another government step. Meloni's failure to attract the young has often been masked by voter apathy. Turnout in Italy is normally low among under-35s, who, rather than express their dissatisfaction by voting against the government, have simply opted not to vote. However, this trend reversed abruptly at a referendum in March on a reform of the justice system championed by Meloni. Some 67% of under-35s cast a ballot, with 60% of them rejecting the reform, compared with an overall turnout of 59%, of whom 54% voted no. Sensing trouble, days before the crucial referendum, Meloni had joined an irreverent podcast hosted by a popular rapper in a bid to reach younger voters. "The referendum showed what impact the young can have if they vote en masse," De Sio said. "At the next election, they could be decisive." Swiss government urges parliament to reject initiative opposing EU deal. By Reuters. Zurich. The Swiss government on Thursday recommended that parliament reject an initiative aimed at blocking a new agreement between Switzerland and the European Union that would mark the biggest overhaul in bilateral economic relations in a generation. Backed by the billionaire founders of Swiss asset manager and private equity firm Partners Group, the so-called Compass Initiative aims to protect Swiss independence by broadening the scope of compulsory referendums on state treaties. Agreed in December 2024, the EU-Swiss deal is currently being debated in the Swiss Parliament. If passed, it is likely to face a referendum in 2027 at the earliest. The ruling Federal Council said the Compass Initiative would create legal uncertainty, disrupt Switzerland's established democratic system, and threaten legal and economic stability. "Instead of clarity, it creates more uncertainty and problems," Justice Minister Beat Jans told a press conference. The initiative seeks to make international treaties require approval from not just a majority of voters, but also a majority of its 26 cantons, which would raise the bar for passing such accords. It also opposes the so-called dynamic alignment of laws foreseen under the EU-Swiss deal, in which Switzerland, subject to its own constitutional safeguards, adapts its legislation to relevant changes in EU law. The Federal Council said the initiative's provisions on the adoption of law under international treaties are so unclearly formulated that they would create serious legal uncertainty. The initiative will be put to a referendum after gathering enough signatures, although no date has yet been decided. Blast at Rotterdam Port Energy Facility kills one person. by Charlotte van Kampenhout and Inti Landoro, Amsterdam. A blast at a storage facility for petroleum products at the Netherlands' Rotterdam port killed one person and wounded several others on Thursday, officials said, adding that the cause was unknown. A spokesperson for major energy commodities trading company Gunvor said an incident occurred during maintenance work on a storage tank. Pardon me. A police spokesperson said that there was no immediate sign of sabotage and that all possible scenarios were under investigation. Rotterdam is Europe's largest port and comprises oil refineries, liquefied natural gas terminals, and multiple petrochemical facilities. Shell, ExxonMobil, and Gunvor Energy are among the energy majors operating at the port. The explosion occurred at around 11:30 a.m. Gunvor said it was cooperating with local authorities. Shell said its operations at the port were unaffected by the blast. A Rotterdam port spokesperson said LNG terminals were not affected. ExxonMobil shut all units at its 191,000 barrels a day Rotterdam refinery due to a power outage, consultancy Wood Mackenzie said in an alert to clients seen by Reuters. ExxonMobil did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Rotterdam Port said there was no connection between the blast and the power outage. Total darkness, then sunset, as full eclipse wows spectators in Spain. By Corina Pons, Tom Little, and David Latona. Madrid, Reykjavik. Spectators across Spain watched in wonder, some whipping off their protective glasses and rising to their feet in unison, as a rare total solar eclipse swept across the north of the country on Wednesday evening, plunging it into darkness. Spain deployed a massive police contingent and set up special viewing spots across rural areas that offered the best views of the spectacle. Viewers in Buitrago de la Soya, a rural district north of Madrid, clapped and cheered as the sky dimmed and Bailey's beads, bright points of sunlight that shine around the edge of the moon during a total eclipse, glistened on the horizon just after 8:30 p.m., lasting barely a minute. It's impressive how the colors return little by little after totality, first the reds, then the blues, just like at dawn and sunset, totally deceiving your brain, said economist Diego Fernandez, 32. Rafael Jimenez, 50, a resident of Madrid, said the event felt like science fiction. It was an absurd scene. We even got soaked when the garden sprinklers kicked in, he said, and then, just like that, we were watching the sunset again. Spain's turn with the eclipse followed shortly after a less remarkable spectacle over much of overcast Iceland, although a break in the clouds in the far west of the Nordic country allowed holidaymakers and locals a glimpse of the celestial phenomenon. The eclipse was hidden behind clouds in central Reykjavik, although the darkness of the totality was still evident. It was like a whole day just came at once, and I felt goosebumps because it just made us think about the shortness of life, how time can be different, and it depends on your perspective, lawyer Eduarda Ortiz, 33, told Reuters in the Icelandic capital. Millions of people gathered in Iceland and northern Spain to witness Western Europe's first total solar eclipse in 27 years. Brian May, a former guitarist for the rock band Queen, was among them. He traveled to an observatory in Spain's Teruel province and chronicled the experience on his Instagram page. "Here we go, the sun is disappearing, it's amazing," he said, as the eclipse reached its climax and bystanders burst into cheers and applause after a countdown. In Spain, authorities were expecting up to 6 million visitors, in mostly rural areas under the eclipse's path across the north of Spain and the Balearic Islands. The Iberian Peninsula last witnessed a total solar eclipse in 1912, but another is due on August 2, 2027, and an annular eclipse will follow in January 2028, completing the so-called Iberian Eclipse Trio. The uncanny sensation when day briefly turns to twilight and some animals fall quiet, while the moon passes directly between the Earth and the Sun, has often been seen through history as an omen of cosmic struggle or a sign of divine power. For Spain, the event has been a chance to showcase its less traveled regions and draw tourists from its overcrowded beach resorts. Some seize the opportunity to get married, according to local press reports. The eclipse took place in one of the country's highest risk periods for wildfires, with emergency crews fighting various fires on Wednesday, including a large one in the southern Andalusia region. Authorities rolled out a large-scale police operation and public safety campaign to make sure the crowds did not set off wildfires. A small fire erupted near an eclipse viewing point in the town of Peñíscola in the Valencia region, local authorities said. The fire began in a vehicle and spread to 33 more before firefighters brought it under control, they said. Emergency crews, including aircraft, were dispatched to the area. The authorities dispatched 25,000 police officers to guarantee security around the eclipse observation sites and deployed nearly 100 planes and helicopters. As of late Wednesday, no wildfire incident tied to eclipse chasers was reported. In Reykjavik, glasses that allow spectators to view the phenomenon without damaging their eyes have been sold out for days, as the country of roughly 400,000 people welcomed up to 80,000 visitors. Totality reached Iceland's westernmost coast at about 5:44 p.m., casting the far west of the island nation into total darkness for up to 2 minutes and 13 seconds. The event has drawn both casual observers and eclipse chasers, enthusiasts who crisscross the globe to be in the path of totality whenever and wherever an eclipse occurs. In Spain, 43-year-old Gemma, who did not give her last name, said she left the Butrago de la Soya viewing point. "Everyone tells you about it, but it is more beautiful than you imagine." UK's Farage. Pardon me, a small technical problem. Reform UK's Farage faces off against Count Binface in election. By Andrew McCaskill. London. Voters cast their ballots on Thursday in a local English election pitting Nigel Farage against his main challenger, a comedian dressed as a trash can, in a test of opposition to the Reform UK leader's brand of populist politics. After weeks of facing accusations that he failed to properly declare millions of pounds received from a wealthy backer, Farage abruptly resigned from Parliament last month to seek a new mandate in a People Against the Establishment election in the seaside resort of Clacton. While Farage aims to demonstrate his strong local support to bolster his position against the charges, the decision by major parties not to put up candidates has left him facing more than 30 rivals, including comedians and independents, in what will be the longest ballot paper in British political history. His main rival is likely to be Count Binface, a silver cape-clad character created by comedian Jonathan Harvey, who has run against three prime ministers over the last decade to poke fun at them. Joke candidates are a normal feature of British elections, where it only costs £500, $676, to enter a contest, but they are usually not the main competition. Farage said last month the vote would allow his constituents to judge the allegations that he failed to properly declare a £5 million, $6.8 million donation from a billionaire. Lawmakers must normally declare donations received in the year before an election within a month of taking office, and Parliament's Standards Commissioner has opened an investigation into whether any rules were broken. If Farage is found to have breached the rules, he could face sanctions that trigger another election in the area. Farage has repeatedly denied having an obligation to disclose the donation, which he said was a personal gift. The area of Clacton in eastern England was once a popular holiday destination for Londoners, but is now a fading seaside town that includes the village of Jawick, rated as the nation's most deprived neighborhood. Meta says it has taken down 756,000 Australian teen accounts as ban enforcement looms. By Reuters. Sydney. Facebook and Instagram owner Meta said on Thursday it had taken down more than 750,000 accounts it suspected were held by Australians age under 16 since a world-first ban on teen accounts, and promised more action in the face of possible regulatory intervention. The company said it had deactivated 462,000 suspect Instagram accounts and 294,000 suspect Facebook accounts from just before the Australian social media ban went live in December to June, up from 331,000 Instagram accounts and 173,000 Facebook accounts it said it had removed by January. The world's largest social media company has said it wants to comply with a law it and other platforms have vocally opposed, just as Australia's internet regulator considers an enforcement lawsuit against platforms, including some that Meta owns, that it says have failed to take sufficient steps to comply with the law. No other platforms have released compliance data that matches the date range given by Meta, but Australian government figures and multiple independent studies have shown more than 8 in 10 under-16s were still on social media in the ban's first months. The Australian government proposed the landmark law, which came into effect on December 10, on concerns about social media's impact on the physical and mental health of children and young teens. With other countries around the world considering similar age restrictions, Australia has accused the platforms of intentionally setting the ban up to fail and has introduced a law to double the maximum penalty for non-compliance to $99 million Australian dollars, $69.75 million American dollars, and give the regulator greater document discovery powers. Representatives of Meta, TikTok, YouTube owner Google, and Snapchat are scheduled to give evidence in a parliamentary inquiry about the changes on Friday, as are regulatory and government officials. Enforcement is ongoing, and these numbers will continue to grow, Meta said in a statement. We share the Australian government's goal of ensuring young people have safe, age-appropriate experiences online, and we are meeting our obligations under the law, the company added. A 2025 Australian trial of age assurance technology found products on the market could effectively support a ban. Most large platforms, including Meta's, rolled out photo-based age estimation software, although they say they typically first subject users to age inference, or assuming a person's age based on their online activity. Meta said it was using AI to analyze user profiles for contextual clues that an account may belong to someone under 16, such as birthday celebrations or mentions of school grades, and to analyze reports about suspected underage accounts. The company added that it had removed the option for a person to make more attempts to set up an account if their previous account was deleted. In record U.S. wildfire season, firefighter entrapments hit 20-year high. By Andrew Hay. U.S. firefighting personnel are being overrun by wildfires at the highest rate in two decades, leading to 6 deaths and dozens of injuries this year, federal data showed, a grim count during a record-setting fire season in the United States. There have been 12 entrapments so far in 2026, according to the Wildland Fire Lessons Learned Center, a federal agency, already more than the full year average of 9 in the last 20 years, and the highest year-to-date number since 2006. Wildfire entrapments are life-threatening situations in which fire behavior compromises the escape routes or safety zones of firefighting personnel. The sheer number and scale of wildfires this year, which experts attribute in part to climate change caused by burning fossil fuels, means increased risk for firefighting personnel. 7 active and retired fighters told Reuters they were also concerned firefighters were taking unusual risks because of an all-out approach to stopping fires mandated by the Trump administration. They also questioned the impact of U.S. Forest Service staffing cuts as part of broader federal downsizing. A spokesperson for the U.S. Forest Service, part of the Department of Agriculture that has historically taken the lead on fighting wildfires, said firefighter safety was the agency's highest priority, and investigations were ongoing into the incidents of firefighters being trapped by flames. The USFS did not immediately respond to requests for comment on the impact of all-out fire suppression tactics and staffing cuts. The newly created U.S. Wildland Fire Service, which aims to consolidate federal firefighting forces under the Interior Department, said it was reviewing the entrapments to improve firefighter safety. After a historically low winter snowpack, record temperatures, and decades of drought in the U.S. West, the country is facing an intense fire season. The National Interagency Fire Center said 6.4 million acres have burned to date, the highest August 12 level on record, and about 5 times the area burned in Europe this year. U.S. firefighters have had to respond to over 46,500 wildfires, the highest number in over a decade. That means they face danger for longer periods of time in drier, more extreme fire conditions, which heightens risks, said U.S. Forest Service Fire Specialist Wesley Page, who has researched entrapments. Entrapment deaths normally account for around 4 of the average 17 fatalities each year of wildland firefighting personnel in the United States, according to National Interagency Fire Center and USFS data. So far in 2026, 6 of the 13 people who died fighting fires were entrapped, based on Wildland Fire Lessons Learned Center data. Around a quarter of 2026 entrapments involved helicopter-borne firefighters, or so-called helitac crews, often dropped near blazes to create firebreaks. 4 helitac fighters died, and 1 was severely burned, after a June 27 entrapment in Colorado's Knowles Fire, the most deadly entrapment in 13 years. The fact that 3 incidents may involve helitac crews does not necessarily mean helitac operations have become more dangerous, the U.S. Wildland Fire Service said in a statement. Other entrapments involved Washington fire crews who abandoned vehicles after they caught fire, and bulldozer drivers overrun by flames in Washington and Oregon as they scraped fire breaks. Current and former firefighters say they were concerned fire personnel were taking more risks than usual after officials in President Donald Trump's administration stressed putting out all blazes immediately, an approach known as full suppression. Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins, responsible for the Forest Service, said in an April letter to staff that her top priority was to accelerate initial attack and use a full suppression strategy. Reva Duncan, president of firefighter advocacy group Grassroots Wildland Firefighters, said that was not always appropriate, given conditions on the ground were insanely volatile with extreme dryness and strong winds. We can't put people in front of some of these fires, we just can't, said Duncan, who worked as a fire duty officer on blazes in the U.S. Southwest this year. U.S. Wildland Fire Service Director Brian Fennessy told the Hot Shot Wake Up podcast earlier this month that he was confused by 2025 policies encouraging firefighters to be more aggressive on initial attack, the first response to a wildfire, adding their procedures were already aggressive. Aggressive does not mean taking extra or extraordinary risk of harming your people, he said. U.S. Forest Service Fire Specialist Page, who works in Colorado, said the agency's emphasis on full suppression may have made firefighters on the Knowles fire act more aggressively than they would normally. Page, assigned to firefighting duties in the same area around 2 days after the entrapment, said a blaze like the Knowles fire would die by itself once the wind dropped due to the area's rough terrain and relatively sparse vegetation. Scott Fitzwilliams, former supervisor of Colorado's White River National Forest, said full suppression marked a return to failed 20th century policies that led to the buildup of forest fuel now driving the country's wildfire crisis. He said over 6,000 USFS job cuts in 2025 during federal downsizing had wiped out the support structure for the agency's 11,300 firefighters and caused higher fatigue. The pressure to put out all fires when they are small puts firefighters at risk, said Fitzwilliams, who retired last year and knew Emily Barker, one of rifle hell attack crew members, who died in the Knowles fire and worked in his forest area. Taylor Farms outbreaks show limits of U.S. ability to safeguard produce from Mexico. By Cassandra Garrison. Mexico City. Two foodborne illness outbreaks linked to Taylor Farms have exposed a weakness at the heart of North America's food system. The United States is increasingly relying on Mexico's produce industry, and regulators are straining to oversee it to keep consumers safe. Taylor Farms, the $7 billion company that supplies fast food chains, major food distributors, and grocers, recalled prepared products containing jalapenos this week after U.S. authorities linked a salmonella outbreak that has sickened several hundred to peppers imported from Mexico. It followed a major cyclosporiasis outbreak traced to iceberg lettuce Taylor Farms imported from Mexico that has made more than 6,300 people sick and caused two deaths. The back-to-back incidents have revived concerns over the FDA's ability to oversee imported food, experts say. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration's employment fell by 22% in 2026 compared to 2024, according to agency data, in part due to workforce cuts since Donald Trump returned to the White House. Foreign food facility inspections by the FDA fell nearly 13% in fiscal 2025, while imports have continued to rise. Without question, the cuts are harmful to food safety, said Jennifer McIntyre, founder of the U.S.-based Food Safety Strategy Consultancy, as is having decreased oversight to what's actually happening as outbreaks occur. The FBI did not respond to a request for comment. The U.S. imported less than $3 billion in agricultural products from Mexico in 1993, the year before the North American Free Trade Agreement took effect, according to U.S. Department of Agriculture data. That level has increased by nearly 1,500% through 2025. Mexico now accounts for more than 20% of all U.S. food imports, according to Luis Rivera, an agricultural economy expert at Texas A&M University. The U.S. imported $16.1 billion in fresh produce in 2025, according to a university analysis. We don't have to wait for products to be in season for us to consume it year-round, said Rivera. Having those partners is very important for the affordability of food here in the U.S. Yet the same supply chains that keep U.S. grocery shelves stocked have also periodically exposed consumers to foodborne illness. U.S. food safety investigations over the last two decades have traced outbreaks to imported Mexican fruit and vegetables, including peppers, cantaloupes, cilantro, and leafy greens. The outbreaks have prompted scrutiny of irrigation water, sanitation practices, and food safety controls across the fragmented networks of growers, packers, and distributors. The FDA has imposed safeguards in some regions, though those exporters, growers, and processors in Mexico are already subject to U.S. food safety requirements. However, there is no uniform certification policy requiring all Mexican produce suppliers to demonstrate their irrigation water is safe before exporting to the U.S., experts said. Cristobal Chavez, a food safety researcher at Mexico's National Laboratory for Research in Food Safety, said agricultural water is a persistent vulnerability in fresh produce production in Mexico. Taylor Farms temporarily shut down the Guanajuato processing facility that U.S. officials traced to the cyclosporiasis outbreak. In a statement, the company said that its water sources are tested for fecal indicator organisms. The ongoing outbreak of cyclosporiasis was not the first link to Taylor Farms in Mexico. In 2013, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention linked restaurant-associated illnesses in Iowa and Nebraska to a bagged salad mix from Taylor Farms in Guanajuato. Historically, the FDA has responded to illness outbreaks by placing particular products and regions under import alerts. Firms that demonstrate compliance with additional safety, tracing, audit, and testing requirements may qualify for the agency's so-called green list and avoid being held at the border without needing inspection first. Yet, the green list system does not apply broadly across Mexican agriculture, and the twin outbreaks involving Taylor Farms and Mexican produce have prompted questions about whether existing oversight tools are sufficient. That concludes this Thursday's reading from Reuters. My name is Jean, and it's been my pleasure to read for you.